Okay, we're going to begin with the questions for these three men. If you have any other questions, just hold your hand up and someone will come and pick up the question from you. We'll start with question for David Jansen, since he was the last one we just heard. This question says, the change in physical properties and the climate is upheld by many non-creationists in relation to evolution. A lot of the Big Bang Theory people say that you had climate change, you had changes in properties. So how do the varying properties in the various time periods, how do they differ from this? How would you explain that?
Yeah, the epochs that are, the biblical epochs are very distinctive and defined times, and they're not spread out over millions and millions of years. Whenever I've heard them talk, I mean, you have Big Bang before something, and then something existed and so forth. They're really leveling that thing out and making all kinds of stuff gradual and still pretty much operating from the premise that our present physical laws are what were in place and have always been in place, and that's what was operating earlier. And that's the distinctive. The epoch concept, which comes from Kurt Wise, maybe by other people, suggests that those things were, in fact, distinctly different during those times. And we can see it even particularly genetically with how long people lived. That's a very tangible example with the biblical data. So I think it's still quite different.
Oh, thank you. That's good. Yeah, we were cutting off your faces. And okay, very good. All right, this one's for Bob Bryant. And it's Genesis 4:16, Cain went out from the Lord's presence. How does that relate to God's forgiveness and protective love of Cain?
I think that just means he went out from the, physical movement away from where God was, probably in Eden, and could have been the Shekinah glory of God or pre-incarnate Christ. Is just moving spatially, not spiritually.
And by the way, this wasn't on the question, but it occurred to me as you were talking, does this relate to Adam and Eve being spatially moved away from the garden?
Right. Similar.
Okay. Here's a question for Lucas. Shouldn't Isaac and Rebekah have taught Jacob or trained Jacob and Esau in the ways of grace, so that not in terms of everlasting life, but I think this question is in terms of their experience of walking with God. Because then the secondary question is, wasn't the whole Abrahamic covenant at stake?
Yes. I mean, I have a thought on it. Some of it's speculation. So what's interesting about Jacob's story is that it says, right, you know, after Jacob's born, and it talks about Esau a little bit, and it says that Isaac loved Esau, Rebekah loved Jacob, and it, so it feels like they're getting kind of different treatment. It tells us that Jacob loved to be in the tent, you know, and we find him cooking dinner, and we find Esau out, and so did they hear the same things? I think probably so, but they may have been getting slightly different messages from mom and dad. As far as should they have been taught about grace, absolutely, just like everybody should be. But there's so many gaps in a narrative, any narrative you read. And so, I don't really remember the second half of the question, so I'm just going to pretend like it
was about
exist.
The Abrahamic covenant.
Yeah, I agree with it.
Okay. All right, this is, there's two different questions on the same issue for David Jansen. I'll read both of them, but there, you can answer them in one fell swoop. We clearly see millions of animal fossils. Where are the fossils of the humans that died? And related to this is, how come we don't see fossils of giant humans who died? Or do we see fossils of giant humans who died?
I'll have to say, I'll take the second question. I don't know. Couldn't tell you on that one. It is interesting, and I think it's a fair observation. From a creationist perspective, we would expect to see more human fossils than we do see. But the conditions are quite distinctive for fossils to be made, and man's ability to adapt to a changing situation probably puts the vast majority of the people just drowning in the water, and some of them being buried. But it's a legitimate observation. The creation scientist that I was watching, and myself from that perspective, not a scientist, but I would have expected to see more human fossils being buried more places. So I don't have a good answer for that. The observation is good and fair.
I might just throw out, some of you may have been to Glen Rose, Texas. Glen Rose has a lot of fossils, one of which I think is a human footprint that's something like size 27.
Maybe they are there.
Which would be someone very large, like 10 feet, something like that. We don't know. And also on these, let's see. Oh, are you back? Thank you. Okay. And there are some strange videos, but I think they've been shown wrong. I saw one with a 7-foot footprint, but I think that one is just someone made up. But, in the book of Revelation, in Revelation 20, I guess it's around verse 14, it says, death and Hades gave up the dead, and the sea gave up the dead that were in it. One of the theories is that the billions of people, we don't know how many, but billions, let's say, who died in the flood ended up in the sea. Well, if they did, we wouldn't find those fossils. There wouldn't be fossils. They'd be eaten by somebody. Okay, this is another one. Well, not somebody, some of the guys down there. Okay.
We're still looking for the Jonah one with the guy inside, since Jonah escaped.
Okay, the question for Bob Bryan is, would Cain have endured the same disgrace or punishment if he had immediately confessed, if he had been quick to respond after he kills his brother and had been responded more quickly?
I doubt it.
Okay. This is going well. All right. Okay. Okay, this is a question for David Jansen. I'm sure you can answer this. What about the fine-tuning of the universe? If the laws of physics were different back then, wouldn't that make life impossible?
The changes that took place did not necessarily affect every single thing that was happening. There were certain things that changed in each epoch based on what God was doing and what God was accomplishing. And in the creation epoch, he put everything in place where it needed to be, the right distances and so forth, and that has remained intact, and I think it's going to remain intact through all of the epochs, even at least till we get to the kingdom. And then the situation changes with the kingdom, and then, of course, eternity as well. But I think in the kingdom, we're probably going to see some change. But otherwise, I just think those sort of things on the macro scale were put in place right at the beginning the way God wanted, and they have stayed there to give us stability and solidness for what God is doing in each one of the different epochs.
Yeah, and explain the word macro.
Macro on the big scale terms of... because I think you have things happening on a smaller scale. The flood is obviously a big scale, but it's on this whole world. It wasn't like the whole universe was flooded. It was macro for the world because it was a big scale, but it wasn't like the sun got flooded. A lot of these things stayed in place and were, in that sense, not directly affected by the macro event that was taking place with a global worldwide flood here on Earth.
Yeah, and by the way, as a quick aside, you can be a young Earth creationist like many of us are and still believe in evolution. You just don't believe that the origins came about through evolution. But once God created everything, evidently in the original creation, there wouldn't have been 400 species of dogs, right? Or 400 varieties of dogs. There would have been one. But they've changed over the course of time. But they're still dogs. Become horses, but there are dogs bigger than little horses and, that kind of thing, but they're still in the category of dogs. They reproduce according to their kind, which isn't necessarily species, by the way. It's kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. So we don't know if kind means species or family or genus, but whatever it is, they stay within that.
Yeah, I would recommend along the line of precision of terminology, Bob, that we don't talk about saying evolution took place unless we specify to say micro change within kind.
Right.
That's a more precise way to, because usually using the word evolution, people are thinking macro. So I'd shy away from using that term, but very readily and easily talk about when God made a God kind, he put in enough genetics for breeding to take place later for all kinds of dogs to take place, but they're still dogs, as has been noted. So be careful with the word evolution. If I use it, I'll usually put macro or micro in front of it, but otherwise have some precision in using that term.
Good. Good point. Okay, this is also for David. Are you familiar with Dr. Brown's hydro-something theory?
I talked to the person that asked that question, and I'm not.
Okay, good. All right. And then we have, wait a minute, I had one more here, which we'll get. This is for Lucas. Was it a sin, do you think, for Jacob to have two wives and two kind of concubines, two half-wives or something? Was that right or wrong for him to have four?
All things are permissible, but not all are beneficial. I mean, God used it.
Okay, that's imposing the New Testament.
Yeah, no, that is. Yeah. Now, it doesn't feel ideal to me. Calling it a sin, I can just say I don't know. I would say that. There's this interesting little passage toward the end of Abraham's life where, after all of the happenings, he marries another and has a number of other children, I guess that's after she died, so I don't know. I really don't know.
All right, maybe all three of you could comment on this, yeah.
I'm from Utah, it's not a problem.
You gonna comment on this? You don't want to comment, or?
It's... There's a lot of mystery in that to me of what God has allowed and what God seems to go along with, not go along with, but still bless.
Right.
But I can't bring myself to say that it wasn't sin, that it was right.
Yeah.
I think men chose to do it, and God graciously worked with them in those choices. But it's a tough question. It's amazing to me how much God keeps working with that decision that you see repeatedly.
Well, David had a lot of wives, but he wasn't like his son Solomon, who had 700 wives and 300 porcupines. Oh, concubine.
Maybe one perspective would be that. I still say I don't know, but would God have blessed him differently had he had one wife? And I think his life would have been easier. I would put it that way. I think it caused trouble. I mean, it caused tension. And so a lot of times, I mean, not all tension comes from sin, but, you know, where there's tension, sometimes it is sin. So it could be.
Yeah, it's interesting when you're reading Genesis, you come upon Lamech, which is one of the descendants of Cain. And it said Lamech had two wives. Well, the text doesn't say whether that's right or wrong. It just, Lamech had two wives. And there's no verse in the Old Testament that specifically forbids polygamy. It may have been sin, but it's not specifically mentioned, thou shalt not have two wives or three wives. And in fact, levirate marriage seemed like it required a second wife if you were already married and your brother died without having a child. Unless, of course, levirate marriage didn't apply if the other brother was already married. We're not told that. Did you want to comment?
Well, the two shall become one flesh. I mean,
right.
That's the foundation
right. That
God established, even though maybe there was no explicit command.
Right.
I just can't imagine that God would approve of going against what he established at the very beginning. Which is repeated in the New Testament. So
Jesus brings that same verse up.
Right. It's, so.
I think you convinced me. I think that's probably the best. I'm with Bob.
Yeah.
That was my wife saying she's glad I just have one. Me too.
Okay. Let's see. We've got... maybe you could, this is for Bob Bryant, please explain what 1 John 3:12, the beginning part of it, where it says Cain is of the evil, was of the evil one. What does that mean?
It means he was doing what the evil one wanted him to do, just like any Christian can and does when we do what Satan wants us to do. Like when Jesus said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan," he wasn't saying he wasn't saved. He was just saying, "You're under the influence of Satan. You're doing what Satan wants you to do." Same with Cain.
And if you read Zane Hodges' commentary on 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, he takes that position all through 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. To be of God is in your experience. To be of the devil is in your experience. Okay, this one's for David Jansen. Please elaborate on your comment, quote, "The geological strata are witnesses of God's authority to judge the world again."
Yeah, good. Because that is my main point. And I think that when we see the geological column and that strata, if we understand that each one of those major stratas represent God causing a major event to happen where land and soil and animals and marine life are being transported across entire continents, it ends up being a demonstration of how powerfully God can work. And so I think those things point to the God who is so powerful, but don't miss the authority part. Because he is God, he has authority to do with his creation as he wishes. And so I think looking at the little lines in the rocks, looking at the geological column, looking at the fossils, every one of them point to the God who we worship, who has the authority and the power and the justice and the mercy and the grace to judge the entire, and he judged the entire world, the people who didn't even believe in him, which you always have, but it didn't matter whether they believed in him. He judged the entire world nevertheless, and he has the power and authority to do so. And those things are like billboards. The Grand Canyon is a billboard of God's power and authority to do that.
By the way, I heard a message by John Whitcomb one time, and some Free Grace people have used him a lot. I don't think he was Free Grace, but maybe he was. But he said, like, you had people in your slides climbing up on to the highest peak they could get so they wouldn't drown, right? He said the idea that everybody died within minutes of the flood, of the beginning of the flood, is crazy. He said it took weeks before the highest mountain peaks were covered. And his suggestion was, Whitcomb said, "I bet lots of people came to faith during that time. Because if you didn't believe before, you're probably going to..." Wait a minute, Noah told us this was going to happen.
And Noah did preach right for 150 years while he was building this thing, and the neighbors were coming and asking what in the world he was doing. He was explaining it to them, so many of them would have heard.
Yeah, so he said you could have had people born again during that time. Yeah, Bob?
Never thought about that till you just said it, but... Jesus says it was in the days of Noah, so shall be in the coming of the Son of Man. Well, we know that after the rapture, a huge multitude of people will be saved during the tribulation.
Right.
So to compare the tribulation to the flood, that's an interesting thought. I'd never thought of it.
If there's some symmetry there.
That's possible.
Yeah.
That there could have been, through the tribulation of the flood, there could have been a large number of people that were saved.
By the way, I was talking when I was in North Dakota one time. I was visiting with a guy who's a PhD in biology, and he said, on the most conservative model, there were at least 1 billion people who died in the flood. He said, we think like million. That would be if you only had 2 surviving children for every pair of parents, because they were living 1,000 years, right? So, And he said if you had lots of surviving children, which there probably were, it could have been 10 billion or more that died in the flood. But don't we tend to think that there were like a couple hundred thousand that died in the flood? Probably not. Okay, here's a good online question. Will Cain get any rewards, or could Cain even rule in the life to come?
I'd like to think so, because I think that God gave him the mark to make him an evangelist. You know, that's not there in the text. I know I'm reading into it, but speculation, but it's what I said this morning. I think Cain had a tremendous testimony to give as long as he lived, and everybody knew who he was, and the mark reminded them of who God is and how gracious he is, so that Cain had a testimony to give. So I think that I wouldn't be surprised if, yes, he will be greatly rewarded and rule in the kingdom. We'll find out someday for sure, but that's just a guess.
Okay, and what for the other two, what about, for example, Noah, and what about, for example, Jacob? Are these guys likely going to be rewarded and ruling in the life to come?
I tend to think so. I think what happens is that points to the Bible recording the truthfully what happened with people, including their imperfections. So Noah doesn't end well at the end in terms of some of the things that he's doing. But isn't that what happens with lots of people? If I look back on my life, it's a mixture. It's got some good points. It's got some bad points. I don't know how if I'm going to end on a good point or a bad point. But I think God is looking at the whole entire thing. And it says that he walked with God. And when God said, I need you to build an ark, he did it. You know, so I think very much that's going to be the case, but the Bible is honest in recording the imperfection of Noah, but I think that it's like, that's a bit of a comfort because I have that too, you know, so.
Yeah, so I didn't play real fair with Jacob. In the last half of his life, he does seem to change a bit. I mean, there's still trouble, and a lot of the trouble then comes from his kids who are, you know, murderers and selling their brother as a slave. But what you see with Jacob is there's a few. So my original thought for the talk was to go through all the theophanies and just say, let's just look at where God reveals himself to Jacob. And then it kind of grew into something else. But if you look at those and you just compare those moments in the beginning, you know, that moment where he kind of bargains with God and he seems a little bit skeptical. By the end of his life, God has a few times where he says, don't be afraid to go to Egypt. And he does it. He just obeys. And so what I see at the end of Jacob's life is actually obedience. I mean, yes, there's tension. Yes, there's some trouble. But he seems like God brings him to the place where he does obey. And obedience is, you know, it results in reward for believers. So I think Jacob will be rewarded.
Okay. One final question, and this is just, Bob, defending your explanation. Why do most translations use the words punishment and bear instead of iniquity and forgive?
I have no idea.
Okay. See, that's Sean and I on the radio program. We can answer any question.
I think, though, that I don't know. I'm not. Others here are much better experts on this than me. But I feel like people that translate the Bible look at previous translations, and I think that they can't help but be influenced by the translation tradition. That would be my guess.
Yeah.
But this one on iniquity, I don't understand it when it's so predominantly translated iniquity rather than punishment.
And that was in Psalm 32?
Yeah.
52, Psalm 50. Or which one was it? 32.
32. I want to add, it's not to the question, but we've got 2 minutes and gives me a chance to say something that I wish I'd said earlier.
Okay.
When Adam and Eve were promised everlasting life, I'm sure God told them that once you're saved, you're always saved.
Right.
I'm sure that Abel preached that once you're saved, you're always saved. But the first human being born to a man and a woman demonstrated that once you're saved, you're always saved. And it came to me that I always thought that Bob Wilkin was the founder of GES. I've changed my view. I now believe that Cain was the founder of Grace Evangelical.
Okay, this is great. We'll start putting that out there.
You were preempted by Cain.
Yeah, okay. How about, you're right, since we got a minute to go, would you guys like to make a summary statement? Something you forgot to say? No?
I just did.
Oh, you just...
I'll say something real quick. One thing that was interesting to me is that, I don't know what lesson is in this, but it seems that the sin that sort of, I mean, in a sense, gets passed down from Abraham to Isaac, then to Jacob, it seems like it increases each generation until you get to Reuben and Simeon murdering a city of people who have just been circumcised. And so I think it kind of illustrates that same idea that I think one of the long narrative messages in Genesis is God saves the most wrecked people, the most, you know, just people that do rotten things, and he chooses them and he gives them his favor. And so it's a beautiful message when you see the narrative kind of in a large swath.
I'm good.
Okay, let's give him a warm hand.